Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 351st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Kyle McConaughey and our buddy Hart Perez, who just stopped me at a restaurant last night and told me hello, which made me really happy because no one has ever said hi to Matt before that's a fan of the podcast, but I get it all the time. Anyhow, I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Jeff Bigos on the show. He's the director of Christmas Bloody Christmas and also previous neon-drenched horror films VFW and Bliss, among others. It's an awesome conversation. I had so much fun. He really epitomizes just shooting it, but also blows up cars, breaks glass, does all these crazy stunts, takes over towns. It's truly an inspiring, super fun conversation.
I mean, my favorite part of this talk is just him saying that producers tend to tell you what you can't do because it's too expensive. And then he just goes on like Amazon.com and proves them wrong. He's like, we can do this. We can make our own thing. We can buy this car and we can blow it up. What's the big deal? And sometimes you think of something that sounds very expensive, you know, like a big stunt, a big car thing, a big something. But when you look at the nuts and bolts of like, how much does it actually cost? You know, if you're making a movie for $100,000 and you can get this like insane stunt for $3,000, then it's probably worth it.
Yeah, you should do it. Flip that car over. I can't tell you how many times I would do double takes while we're talking where you just be like, yeah, and then we made our own breakaway glass and I don't know, was it this or that or whatever? And I'm like, wait, hold on, what? And I think that you and I are pretty hands-on DIY guys. You know, we're down to try things out or put cameras in weird places or go source a thing ourselves all the time. This conversation really made me feel like, oh, what am I doing? I should be homebrewing my own breakaway glass in my oven right now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it didn't make me feel old necessarily, but it made the contrast between indie film and commercial directing
like, sure,
incredibly stark because sure, he's basically making movies for himself and we are directing mainly for other people. It's never clearer than when you're like, fuck it, I'm going to jump on the, you know, on the hood of this car and film the actor through the window as they crash through a fence. You just could never, ever do that on anything that we work on recently. I have done that. I mean, I think almost all of us starting out, you know, have stuck our head and camera out of sunroof and filmed.
Sure.
Filmed yeah, something.
Man, back in the day, we used to do that stuff on a big network TV show. We would do it all the time. We would lean out of cars all the time. In open traffic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just like in the valley, just like in Burbank. And I think we got in trouble for it, which is good because I was like, I don't know that this is, like, well, can't we just do this the right way, everyone? We were not doing it the right way. It was unsafe, and I regret it, actually. But that's different than what Joe's describing. And I think that if listeners take anything away from the show in general, it's just go shoot it. But also, like, this conversation should excite you, should motivate you, and should remind you that just because people do it a certain way doesn't mean it has to be done that way. And we are all privileged with growing up in the era of YouTube and cheap cameras. And there's a lot of stuff you can figure out yourself that you used to have to, like, literally, you know, go to a weird warehouse in Burbank to buy or go to a library and become a chemist to figure out. And, like, Joe's just doing it. And it was a really fun conversation. I'm really glad that we made it happen.
Yeah. I mean, the other interesting thing is that he shoots all his movies on 16 millimeter film, no matter what the budget is, which, you know, to us is like, that must be so expensive. But he's done, you know, like $200,000 movies on 16 millimeter film. And his last movie is a $2 million movie. So it's called Christmas Bloody Christmas, and it is out right now. It is definitely Christmassy and definitely bloody. And you can watch it on Shudder.
I don't think we normally do any sort of adult warnings, but this one, maybe, I think maybe there's a few more F-bombs than normal and stuff. So if you've got kids in the car, you don't want them to hear about that or about some of the dangerous stuff that, you know, people pull off trying to make a great movie, then maybe skip this one. But for everyone else, strap the F in.
What do you mean by the F? Just to, for clarity?
Fart. Strap the farts in, because it's such a good episode that you got to hold them in because you don't want to be distracted by anything.
Before we talk to Joe, I want to remind everyone we have a Patreon, patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place you can go and just tell us that you like the show. We have a bunch of fans on there and we really, really appreciate it. You know, if you feel like you get anything out of this, maybe we helped you book something. Maybe you had a job you were nervous about and then Matt and I talked about a worse way to do it and made you more confident all of a sudden. If you at all feel like this show is helpful to you and you want to help support it, help pay our editor and all of our web serving things and all those other things, go to patreon.com/justshootitpod. If you join at the $20 level, even for 1 month, you'll get a Just Shoot It hat. It just, you know, was on a shoot at the Universal lot and a lot of people
very cool
saw it and were instantly jealous of me. A lot of very successful people. We're like, where can I get this hat? And I told them on my podcast and they said, oh, you have a podcast? And then I was like, yeah. And I started telling them about it and they just walked away. Anyhow, Just Shoot It Pod. Check us out on Patreon. We appreciate it greatly. And let's go on with the show.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Joe, hello.
How's it going, man?
Joe Bigas, thanks for joining us on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Been a very long time since we recorded on the weekend.
Yeah, truly, truly.
But you're in the middle of production.
Right, after midnight on the weekday or during the weekend. So I'm typically not allowed to do a weeknight. But
I imagine since you work in horror a lot, what percentage of your shoots would you say are night shoots?
Well, I've reached my final form of the Christmas movie was every single night. It was 38 straight night shoots of not one.
I
wanted to do VFW all nights because the movie takes place all at night, but you know, my entire cast was like 70, so that didn't really
fall. they were like, no, we won't do that.
So like it was like 8 hours of nighttime, but it worked out because we had a little bit of daytime stuff, but in order to do like a proper day, we would do 12-hour days, and at the start of day we would do like 4 daytime shots. So that's why, thank God, all of our daytime shots are at sundown.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, we're going to shoot in sequence for the most part, and let's just pop off like 3 shots today of daytime. So, I mean, that's the, I wish everything could be at sundown. That's the way I'm doing the movie now. But like that schedule worked out perfectly because we'd never go over, and, you know, we got to do night shoots every single day, and we got fucking Tony Scott sundown every single day for all the daytime shots. So like that's the way I want to go from now on. If I do have any sort of daytime shots in my movie, it's like, shoot it all the last 45 minutes of the day. So it's fucking beautiful.
Yeah.
And you never get stressed out about like losing, like not getting a scene or a stunt not working or something, and like you just losing the light.
Yeah, that shit always happens. But, you know, that's like the nature, or that's the beauty of it. Cause it's like, you know, unless I'm in a location for one day, you're not gonna be able to get that shit. But like being in LA, I was able to just like pop out and like, let's go get a couple city shots, or we're in the loft, let's, you know, get these couple shots before it becomes nighttime. And, you know, we're able to wrangle all those and kind of malleably push it to the next day. And thankfully, I never have anybody breathing down my neck, so I'm able to like arrange schedules and stuff and always get what I want. And I own like 16 cameras, so every single movie I've done, I've gone out, you know, during editing and just popped off shots that we owe. Even in the Christmas movie, like we did 4 days of shooting in LA, and you'd probably be shocked to know the stuff that we actually did shoot in LA, but...
And is it insert stuff? Is it like, oh, like you can't tell that we're blending scenes together or things like that? Or like what specifically were you guys stealing in those 4 days?
Well, with the Christmas movie, it was like definitely inserts. And then there's a couple like effect shots that I shot in my apartment. All the commercials at the beginning, we shot like 5 days before we had to deliver. All those commercials in my apartment, besides the one with the family.
Where was the one in the family? With the one with the family,
Williamson. We shot that in Burbank at his house.
Oh, okay.
He was, I had with kids who would have done it for free and allowed to put his kids or allowed him to put his kids in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, man, that's cool. I love that. I think, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about the 16mm thing, but I think one of the things Warren and I talk about all the time is how nice it is to just be able to like go grab one of those insert shots, and how flexible and malleable your film can be, you know, like just being able to like be like, oh fuck, I need a hand on a doorknob is always the example. Like just go shoot it. Mm-hmm. You know,
we actually shot a hand on a doorknob for VFW in my bathroom.
There you go, man. There you go. Well, so I'm curious, you've got like this awesome track record and a very clear aesthetic, right? Of like, you're leaning heavy into like saturated neon colors, right? That's like a thing that certainly Christmas Bloody Christmas is doing, but it looks like Bliss and VFW are kind of like at least hinting at now. And it feels like you've like just fucking embraced it pretty head on. And also you're shooting 16mm, right? And so I'm curious, you know, I haven't shot a ton of film in my career, or really any, to be honest. And I love that you're doing this kind of like throwback, you know, like almost homage aesthetic. Tell us why 16mm and maybe some of the surprising pros and some of the surprising cons of shooting with it.
Well, I just, you know, ever since I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, I don't know, my whole life, I guess, I just was always attracted to the look of film. You know, when I was a teenager, I thought it was cool that they were releasing all these dope digital cameras that I could learn shit on. But I still always love the aesthetic of film. And, you know, people who are still shooting on film, like Aronofsky, you know, with The Wrestler and Black Swan and shit like that. And, you know, Irreversibles on 16. I was just always so attracted to the look of it. I always wanted to shoot on it. And, you know, my first couple movies were so low budget that I just shot on digital. And with Bliss, I actually had less money than my previous movie. I only had like $200,000. And, I really like one thing about that was like, you know, we'll do it bare bones guerrilla style, but I want to shoot on 16. I think it's going to lend itself, you know, it needs to look like fucking old school 70s New York City exploitation, basically. So we figured it out and I just budgeted the movie around shooting on 16. And I fell in love with the process so much and the way that it looked that, you know, I just made the call that I was going to do that on every movie. And then, of course, VFW, that's the movie, only movie I've made so far where I kind of had somebody who could veto decisions that I made, and they wouldn't let me shoot 16, and mm-hmm. annoying. But since then, I've now bought cameras, and you know, there's really nobody who can tell me. Like, it's like, if you don't want me to shoot a 16th of a cost thing, I'll just fucking use my cameras for free, and it'll offset the cost. Or like on Christmas, I could just rent my cameras to the production at the same price a rental house would, and you know, make money back on the cameras. But like, it's also the thing where even at this point, 16 millimeter, it's like scientifically better than digital. I mean, 16 millimeter has higher resolution than fucking 8K. Mm-hmm. 65 fucking cameras. So I mean, we're probably one of the only industries where the technology has for some reason went backwards. And sure, you could argue that it's an ease of use, especially back, you know, like when Michael Mann was doing Collateral because of like nighttime footage and all that. But I mean, you guys look at the Christmas movie, and I shot that movie on anamorphic 1.5 lenses. The stock is so fast now, like that scene where it's following them down the road, that's mm-hmm. just practical lighting. We didn't light that fucking street. We hooked up all those Christmas lights, but that's practical lighting, and we're getting all that exposure. So like, it's not even mm-hmm. a fucking lighting thing anymore. It's a slight cost thing, but we're at the point where they've developed the film to be so fast, they've developed lenses to be so fast. And it's like, I mean, I'm loading film on the movie I'm shooting now myself. It takes fucking 10 seconds a roll. It's like, I don't understand. I think the people who, you know, always downplay the hardships of shooting on film have never actually done it, because I'm constantly explaining to my filmmaker friends who are like, you know, 5-6 movies deep. And like Travis Stevens, he just did a Wounded Fawn. I was fucking on his ass. I'm like, dude, just fucking shoot. Oh,
yeah, we know Travis.
And he was like, he did it on a Wounded Fawn. He's like, oh, you're right. You're right. And I'm like, yeah, I just wish that more people would do it, because now it's going to, you know, the more filmmakers, especially indie, that do it, the more accessible certain things are going to become, or the more accessible equipment is going to become, or like, you know, houses that can develop or scan stuff. So yeah, I always want to be able to shoot on film. It's just better. It looks better. And, you know, you get the argument that a lot of people are like, well, the general audience can't tell that it was shot on film. Does it really matter? And it's like, I agree that there's a larger chunk of the audience that can look at two images and say, I can't tell the difference. But I feel like if you're watching a movie, there's a subtextual quality to something that's mm-hmm. shot in film that draws you into the performance more. And I actually think that, you know, I don't know if it's by nature of the actors knowing they are being shot on film and they can't watch their takes, or it's by nature of just the organic process of the chemical look of the film. But I feel like performances are just inherently better. Effects look better, because I always shoot practical effects anyway, so it helps cover up those seams. It makes, like, I just feel like it makes everything look better. And a lot of people don't notice that when they're looking at two images next to each other. It's like digital versus film, but it's just like the organic moving quality of watching draws you in more. And, you know, and when you asked about cons, I don't think there's any cons. I mean, sure, it costs a little more, but anything good. I mean, yeah, if you want cool effects, it's going to cost more. If you want a fucking explosion, it's going to cost more.
Sure. Yeah, that's filmmaking. Yeah. Yeah, I love that, man. Yeah, wild.
Sorry, about the effects. I mean, you could still do visual effects if you shoot film, right? I mean, you're still editing.
Yeah. I've never done like actual CG, but all my movies have wire removal or comp or like, have you guys seen VFW?
I haven't seen it. No.
Okay. There's a shot. Well, actually, it's fucking. Never mind. It's shot on digital, but we could have done it on film. But there's a shot that basically, like, it's on a crane and it's zooming as it pans into a car, and we had the entire highway that surrounds the VFW removed for the entire movie, like with all these shots without even doing props. I mean, you can do all that same shit on film. So like, it's just grain. You know, we shoot grain plates so that the visual I can just replace the grain. And I mean, yeah, there's absolutely no difference whatsoever. And when we edit too, like we bring it to Photocam and we just get drives back that has the footage digitized to however we want. And, you know, just like.
And then you're off to the races. Post-wise, do you go back and like conform on film? Or is it just like once it's digitized that it just is, that's the chain from there on out?
Yeah, that's been the deal with all of our movies. And then I make 35 prints, but it's from the digital master. You know, I've got all the dailies sitting in my fucking closet, which I guess might be a con, because now it's like it's a big fucking ton of stuff stacked up.
It's a lot of hard drives either way, though, right? Like it's all stuff.
Stuff like Once I'm in Hollywood and Licorice Pizza, those movies were they cut on digital and then they went back and actually had a negative cutter cut them, and they do look, you can notice a slight difference. But that's a big cost. I don't know if I'll be able to afford if it got to that point.
And what about, just because I am one of those guys, Joe, where I'm like, yeah, I'd spend the money elsewhere, put it in front of the camera or whatever. But you're making a very convincing argument that I'm very curious about. What about just the amount of footage that you're capable of shooting, like the cost of actual film? Do you know what I mean? Like, did you ever feel limited with the amount of takes you get or anything like that?
No, because when we first started when we did it on Bliss, we looked at our shooting ratio on our previous movie and budgeted for around that. Because I don't like run the camera usually. I mean, sometimes we'll do 6 takes and sometimes I'll do 2 takes. Mm-hmm. But like I said, with actors, I think they're more on point. And I like to rehearse a lot anyway, just because by nature of how I make my movies, there's we're almost like, you know, growing organisms where we're rehearsing and riffing and building stuff up. So I do a lot of rehearsal anyway, which I guess lends itself to shooting on film. But like there were things in Christmas where we're doing 7, 8, 9 takes of long dialogues. And it's just because like that oneer, you know, on the dolly where they talk about the farmhouse and all that shit. Like I wrote that an hour before we shot it, cause we had 4 hours and we shot, you know, 10 takes of that 2-minute scene. And, we still came in, like I had 20 rolls of fucking film left over that I was able to put in my fridge after we shot, because we actually came in under. So I just budget for what my usual shooting ratio is, really like 6-1 or something like that. And honestly, like I said, like with Bliss, it was $60,000 all in back to shoot on film. We made the rest of the way for 140. But I think that 60, it's like, yeah, you could argue, oh, I'll put that elsewhere. But I mean, you could look at that movie and where would you put the 60? I guarantee you think it looks bigger than a $200,000 movie. And that's by nature of the film. Like, even if you watch a trailer for Bliss, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but I mean, like, the entire thing is in a loft in front of downtown LA with a giant fucking 40-foot window with the sun going down in front of it. And if I shot that in digital, the window would be blown out the entire film. We have exposure on the fucking setting sun over the city in front of her, I mean, behind her, and with her exposed. And it's like the multiple levels of exposure that you're getting. Like, if you shot that in a red, the entire fucking thing would be blown out. You'd have to have 5Ks pointed at her, fucking diffuse the windows. And then now you're losing 6 hours setting it up with the 16. You just put a daylight filter in and fucking shoot it. And it looks like a goddamn Tony Scott movie from 1992. So, like, I mean.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
There's like minute things that people don't think about besides just like, well, the cost is this. It's like, yeah, but think about this aspect, you know?
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. The man hours that it takes to like get things. No, man, I fucking love it. And I was like, I have a hunch this is going to be a good conversation. So let's lead with it.
Well, yeah. We talked about this a couple of years ago, but did you watch the last Project Greenlight?
The last one I watched was, oh yeah, the guy who shot the indie on film.
Yeah.
And he was like, this one decision affects every single frame of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, all these other things, a better car crash, a better this, a better that, is like, sure, maybe this moment might be a little higher production value or this a little better, you know, this location's more expensive, but he's like, but this one thing touches every frame. And even though I'm with Matt, like I love digital stuff. I love rolling rolling all day and burning through hard drives. I did respect, like I thought that was like,
yeah.
Even though that guy was like kind of a tyrant, I thought that reasoning was pretty valid, you know, like, hey, I want to make a decision on how my movie looks. And I think this one decision is probably going to be
important.
One of the biggest differences.
Yeah. Well, and what I like the most out of all of this, Joe, is that like, you know, your bottom line is like, because it's important to me in the film, it's going to make everything better. So let's work around it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it's easy to compromise with independent film. Do you know what I mean? You're making a $200,000 movie or whatever your budget is. It's easy. It can be death by 1,000 cuts. Right. And so I think that was part of why I was excited to talk to you. It was like, oh, I think this is a guy who maybe has figured out how to be like, you can't tell me no, right? So tell me a little bit more about, you were saying before that like VFW was the only film where there was someone else, another party who had kind of decision-making power over you. So that means then the rest you're kind of just doing independently without any kind of overlord. Walk us through what is a Joe movie how does it work now? What's your model? What's your system? How are you making films? How are you cranking them out so hard?
You know, I think my thing is I don't really, so far, you know, I don't really care about budget as long as it's something, you know, with a livable wage while I'm making it. Mm-hmm. You know, like Mind's Eye or, you know, Almost Human, just me and my buddy made on credit cards for like $25,000 and sold it for profit, thankfully. And then we were able to like piecemeal Mind's Eye. That was about $400,000 from like 20 different investors because we made money on Mind's Eye. So it kind of just went out and, you know, Zach Zeman, who financed like VHS movies, gave us, put in a portion, which then like we were able to kind of go on top of that. And then, mm-hmm. You know, somebody came to me and they were like, I got $200,000 to make a movie. Do you think you can do it? And I didn't care that it was less than Mind's Eye. I was just like, yeah, let's go fucking do it. Let's figure out, let's look at Mind's Eye and all the issues that, or the, all the things that I think I can do better or that I know I fucked up on. And that's also another thing, is not having somebody making those decisions. If something fucks up in my movie or something's not good, I can take responsibility from it and learn from it. Where if somebody mm-hmm. else makes a decision that I don't like, you can't do that. So with Bliss, I did the same thing. And, you know, I think that just like with my first two movies, I proved that, you know, me and my producing partner can deliver a movie from blank page to releasable master without going over budget or over schedule. And that was what was appealing to the Bliss financier. And then, you know, VFW, I came onto that movie because I actually signed on to that movie before Bliss got financed because I couldn't fucking get anything made. And it was the first movie I was offered that I liked the script, even though I completely overhauled it. And I knew that that company could get me like names of some sort, which I thought was mm-hmm. important to have on my resume, that I could work with actors of a certain caliber, you know, going forward on my independent movie. So it was kind of like one of those things where it was like, there's benefits to this and I want to make a movie. But then Bliss, you know, I got the money for Bliss while I was in pre-production of VFW, and I was like, hey, let's pause this movie because I'm going to go make Bliss. And they weren't happy about that, but I did it anyway. we didn't even cast the movie. Like, I was like, let me shoot it, and if we get a cast, then I'll sideline it. Literally, it took forever to get a cast, and I went and made Bliss, and I left the set of VFW on a Saturday morning. It was like, I was so funny because I was shooting an exploding car. I put the camera down, got in a car, went to the airport from Dallas, flew to New York City, got off the plane in New York City, went to my Tribeca premiere of Bliss, partied all night, got on a plane, flew back to Dallas, got off the plane, and went back and started shooting VFW again.
Shouldered up again. Love that. Yeah, I noticed in the credits that you're a cam operator as well. That's fun, man.
Yeah, I know. And I DP'd my first two movies too. Bliss was the yep. first one I didn't, just because, you know, I wanted somebody. I had never shot film before, so I was nervous about that at the time. But then with Christmas, you know, I was shopping it around, and basically the idea was like, we didn't need a production company. We just need someone to finance the movie. So we weren't looking for like a company to come in and help us develop. We weren't looking for like a Spectrevision or somebody mm-hmm. like that. We're just looking for an entity that will finance the movie. And thankfully at the time, Shudder and RLJ was, because of COVID and like their lack of festivals, they were trying to model where they were just going to cash flow movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they liked what our script, and I was just like, well, you guys financed VFW and all these other movies. The producers on VFW are different than the financiers. Like RLJ and Shutter financed VFW, but I had another company in between. Those are the examples. Mm-hmm. But, so they came in there, and I was like, all right, well, me and my buddy Josh are going to be the producers. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. You know, you have a track record. And, you know, they literally did not come on set. They didn't bother us. We had to do whatever the fuck we wanted, as long as we delivered the movie by September 1st or whatever it was, they could release it. And, you know, it was kind of part of just the deal going in. It's like, we've got four movies, and, you know, you saw the quality of VFW compared to the other ones in that slate you guys did. You've seen what we've done. Like, we're in this, you know. And thankfully for me, I was able to, you know, negotiate all that stuff, and I could do whatever I wanted as long as it was on budget and I delivered the script that they read, like, essentially. And you know, they were true to their word, and I fucking heard nothing. And me and Josh have the only producer credits on that movie. We came in on budget and on time, and you know, fucking much to their surprise, did everything in the script, which I don't think anybody thought we could do.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Because they get two, and they were kind of like, "Well, what are you going to cut out?" And it's like, "Nothing. I'm just going to figure it out." And I fucking figured it out, which, you know, is a blessing and a curse, because now people are going to be like, well, you did this for two. And it's like, yeah, but I wanted seven. You know, I did that. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to run a $10 million movie and then have to go make it for three. But do what you do, you know.
Yeah, man.
Less money than I want. I figure it out. So that's just the fucking way it is, I guess.
And what was the Mind's Eye? What was the budget on that?
A little under 400,000, like 380 maybe.
And I saw, like, just in the trailer, like, you, like, flip a car upside down and stuff.
Yeah.
How much does that cost? Like, how do you set that
up? Yeah.
Well, we shot that in New England. So, like, again, that's the thing where, like, people see it in a script and they get scared. And, like, producers are just like, well, we got to cut that out. And it's like, why? Did you fucking actually look into it? No, you didn't, because you're a fucking lazy asshole who's just going to sit there and be like, well, no, this way. Mm-hmm.
Cars are expensive.
That's a problem with producers, too. Most producers now, I mean, it pisses me off so much because you look at something like fucking Terminator 2 and James Cameron's the only producer on the movie. Now you've got a movie of fucking two people in a house hearing sounds and there's 35 producers on it. It's like, this isn't how fucking movies are made, guys. And a lot of the problem with these producers are is that they've never actually fucking done filmmaking. They just come in, they're a fucking exec, and all of a sudden they're producing a movie and they think they know shit. But like, I've made movies from the ground up. I know how, that's the benefit of having a filmmaker who is a producer, or being a producer who's fucking worked on set, because it's like a lot of these people are just like on VFW, they're like, well, no, you can't do that. And it's like, what do you mean? They literally told me on VFW that they couldn't afford a haze and set the bar. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I own a hazer. They're $100 on Amazon. And they were like, well, who's going to run it? And I was like, I'll Velcro the remote to the fucking camera and press on. And I fucking haze the whole entire movie. And then the producer's like, this is only $100. What the fuck? Why don't we have haze on here? And I'm like, what is wrong? You got, oh my God, this is mind boggling. So like the car thing, you know, people are just like, well, we got to cut that out. It's like, we shot that in New England. We shut down a road. We paid a cop for 12 hours of his salary to fucking sit on each side of the road. It's like, what, $500. We bought a beater car.
Wait, so two cops, like one on each side?
Yeah. What do they make? $25 a fucking hour. Big deal. And then we put one on each side of the road. And then we bought a beater car for like $1,800. And we got a stunt driver and paid him $1,000 to flip it. And then AAA was like $200 to fucking tow the car away. Like it literally cost like $2,800. And we flipped the car. And it's like, yeah, that's the thing is that people are like,
but how did you flip it?
The stunt driver flipped it.
Like, I mean, what do you mean?
You can just give it. And they, you know, just set up a little ramp and fucking flipped it.
Oh, there's a ramp.
Yeah.
Like, did he bring the ramp?
Like 2x4s and like cinder blocks or some shit. it was literally like it was.
Fuck yeah, though, man.
And how did you find a stunt driver in whatever random town you're in?
Yeah, yeah.
We got our stunt coordinator from Boston because we shot in Rhode Island. And, you know, we got this guy who was a stunt coordinator for shit that shoots in Boston. And he kind of just read our script and he was like, he was able, we, you know, fit his days around whatever HBO show or David O. Russell movie he was doing. And he came down and did our shit. And I think he was excited that, like, you know, me and my friends are like, let's flip a car and we're going to throw people telekinetically through the air and then we're going to blow this up. And he's like, all right, well, let's figure this out. And I think he was excited by that. And, you know, you hire a stunt coordinator and they have all this equipment and you have to pay them their minimum wage anyway, which is like $800 a day or something, SAG wise. So it's like, you know, you work with it. That's what I mean. Is like, I actually, it's like, well, we're having the car crash. Let's figure it out. Oh, it only costs $3,000. So now it's like in this movie, I'm like, well, you know what? Because I've done car crashes before. So now it's like blow up like four of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. Let's get into that actually, because that shit looks so good. And I was like, oh, that was the other thing. I was like, man, like, I have no idea how much money this movie costs. You know, Normally you kind of look at stuff and you're like, okay, I can figure it out. But like, you know, walk us through the ambulance crash and then the explosion.
Yeah, well, the good thing about the ambulance
of Christmas, Christmas, Bloody Christmas.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, like there's a lot of ambulance action in that. So there's like a chase and then the crash and then it blows up. It blows up twice. So I was just by nature of like, it's the same vehicle. So we bought two ambulances so that we could have, and then we only used one of them because I did it in a way where it wouldn't get destroyed.
Like a total dumb question, but like, where do you buy an ambulance?
Our production designer had like, you know, he was also vehicles and he just searched around and, you know, he had done movies, you know, he's a production designer by nature. He's actually my production designer on VFW too, but like he just has car people and it's like, you know, are there any ambulances for sale? So we just find ambulances for sale and we found two of them from, I don't know, Texas maybe. And yeah, we just,
and how much is that? Like 10 grand an ambulance?
What was that?
How much does an ambulance cost?
They were, I think it was like 15 grand for both of them. And then we didn't even use one. So we sold it after for like 10 grand. So, and then the cars that blew up are just like the cop car. It was just a shell of a car. And then, you know, we had a team who was basically in charge of a fire and snow who was on set the whole time. And I told them what I wanted. And they worked with a stunt coordinator. They cut the car in half. You know, they put barrels of gasoline in it, which is all it is, just barrels of gasoline, however much fucking gasoline costs. And then we had the stunt driver go through it. And it's just a timed thing. You know, they cut the car in half and then they bolted it and welded it back together and put like railroad stakes through the ground so that when it split in half, it wouldn't fly. And it was so funny because the guy was like, you know, a car wouldn't bust in half like this. I don't think it's a good idea to do that. And I was like, it's going to look fucking awesome. He's like, yeah, but realistically, that's not what would happen. I was like, okay, well, the robot driving the car would, you know, bust it through. And then we did it. And he was like, oh, it looks fucking awesome. That same thing. It's like, it didn't really, I mean, the nature of, it's a shooting day. It's almost a whole shooting day, which I guess
sure.
is a big cost. But the thing is like, you know, you do something like that. And then, you know, right before lunch, you blow a fucking, you split a car and have them blow it up. And your crew is like amped. And then they're fucking working on overdrive the second half of the day. So, you know, that's another thing, just because I had done these cars things before, I had a general idea that it's not scary to like wade into it. Let's figure it out. And, you know, we fucking figured it out. And then the same thing at the end, like that was just a fucking car that didn't move or didn't have an engine. They just put gasoline barrels in it, fucking blew it up.
Have you ever done like a big stunt, like one of these things where you get one take and just been kind of disappointed in how it turned out?
Probably. I'm trying to think. I've just like learned to live with things.
Because like that's happened to me a lot. We're like, oh, this guy's gonna fly in the air. This thing's gonna explode. This car is gonna crash into this car. And then you're like, yeah, that didn't have the impact that I was hoping for. And they're like, well, we told you get one take. You know?
Yeah, I don't. I think I've been generally. I think also like the things I try and do are so ridiculous that like, you know, like in mind's eye, I wanted the car to barrel roll like seven times and it only flipped once, and it's like, man, that still looks cool. You know?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I guess to your credit, like I might have been like, if this coordinator is like, yeah, this isn't really how it would work. That like, you know, a car wouldn't split in half and be like, well, how would it work? Okay, maybe we can go with that. You know, and then it would not look that cool because it's like.
Yeah.
A lot of times the reality of like what it looks like when you, yeah.
Yeah.
Blow well, someone's head off is like not.
You know, the ambulance hits a car and then all caps, it splits in fucking half and explodes. It's like, well, yeah, that's exciting to read. Like, and it's going to be exciting to watch. Just think about the visual of it. The camera is going to be here and you'll see it. And yeah, I don't know. I try to never compromise.
Yeah, man. I love it. The other thing, how many cameras did you have rolling on? Typically do you have on a big stunt like that?
That was three.
Three. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I have two cameras, two 16 cameras, and my DP on that movie owns one. So that was our package for the movie.
Which camera is it?
We had two Arri 16 SR3s, which are our main camera. And then I have this Aton Minima, which is a 16 camera that's literally like this big. It's so fucking awesome.
Like the size of a bread loaf for listeners at home, give or take. Or a football, maybe. Yeah, yeah.
But then you have to put the film mag on top of it.
Oh, that's with the film mag. It's a 200 foot. And it's also a daytime mag. So like you can just load it wherever. You're not going to go darker, but load it. And it's really light. And I bought that for Bliss because there's a lot of shots on Bliss with the cameras attached to her body. And in Christmas, that's also the camera I use for the POV. I did all the POV shots. But... it's so light and the wide lens, you put a huge wide lens on it. And in that camera, like that's what Gaspar Noé shot all of Irreversible with, because it's so light, you could throw it around everywhere. And thank God I bought that. I bought it with Bliss because nobody in LA rented it. It's literally like the most advanced, smallest and lightest weight 16 camera imaginable, but they only made like 200 of them because digital came out. So I bought one on Bliss for like $6,000. And now they're like $35,000. And that's the same thing. Like my SR3, I bought for like, I don't know, 14, and now they're $40,000 over like a few years. Like, because there's only X amount of film cameras. That's why I don't know why any of these companies don't just start making them again, make a fucking killing. But anyway, I don't know why I got into that. But yeah, so those are the cameras that we use. That's our basic package.
Killer. Yeah. Yeah. I think, I feel like I would be like, well, what if I put a GoPro or two in there as well? And then, you know.
Well, I've never done that because I know that it would suck.
Yeah, it would suck.
And then it would suck if it was in there. So like, I sort of want myself the option.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's funny because you're like also the DP or at least the operator. So you're like, you know, I mean, I think many of us have worked with DPs that like will not let something into the lens that they think might be used that they hate, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where I'm like, yeah, just shoot, just point the camera
just
down.
Like, come on, man, just do it once. I just need it. Yeah. Hell yeah, man.
And how much, sorry, just for 200 feet, I'm just curious about this Aton Minima. how many, you said 200 feet of 16 millimeter yeah. film. How much shooting time do you get out of that?
6 minutes.
6 minutes. Okay.
Cool. And then the SR3s, the 400 foot mags are about, that's like 1155.
Okay, cool.
Seconds
or so.
Crazy.
And yeah, that's crazy, man. Where did you shoot?
We have all the mags preloaded, so it's like if we run out of a mag, it's like you just pop it off.
You just pop it in.
Yeah. It's like putting a battery, literally. So again, it's like, as long as your film loader or your AC has a shield preloaded, like it's running out of film on a mag is not a big deal.
No big deal. Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard people talk about how there's a rhythm to it as well. You know, it's kind of like when you used to have like smaller cards. There's something nice about like, okay, the immediacy of like, we've only got 5 minutes left on this mag, so let's just get it done right. You know what I mean?
The fucking mag runs out in the middle of a take.
sure. Okay. I mean, that happens on digital too, though, man. Because I think the other thing, like to Oren's point, like how much footage do we have that's just like, okay, hold the, like, still rolling, and then you go fucking talk to the actors for 5 minutes and then come back to monitor. Well, and then call action.
Actors for
yeah, because the truth is, and maybe it's different with film, but like still rolling is kind of director code for like nobody do anything. I don't want you to like wardrobe, hair and makeup. Yeah. Like we're in the moment. So if I cut, then all of a sudden HMU is going to come in and like, you know, brush somebody off or like fix a collar or like somebody's going to go get a fucking snack or something. So that's the truth. That's why you do it. Right. But it's like, you know, cause you can't say nobody fucking move, cut, walk over and say, you know, like it just doesn't, or maybe you could, I don't know. Maybe I just had to train the crew a little bit better, but like,
no, yeah, I do that all the time too. Thing, right. I try to do series just cause, yeah, once you cut, like 100 notes are coming in too. So
yeah. That's the other thing.
It's like you want to keep your momentum, and it's different when you're making your own movie.
Yeah,
because you don't get 100 notes after. A take. You know,
we Oren and I do a lot of commercials. So like, there's a fucking, you know, tent full of client and agency people who, as soon as I call cut, are going to come tell me to like ask someone to smile more or like say the brand towards the
lens a little bit more.
And you're just like, no, I'm just trying to get this joke right real quick. You know?
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about the practical effects? Obviously, you created a lot of heads, like copies of actors' heads.
Mm-hmm. You're splitting people in half. You're gouging eyeballs out. Yeah. Walk us through that a little bit.
Again,
yeah.
Something that I believe a producer would think is very expensive to do, but you're doing it like over and over and over again in these movies. Like, how do you do that on your budgets and like and so fast?
I think it's just, well, the I think it's a kind of a thing too where it's like you figure out what your budget is. You know, we've usually do like 10%, because my movies are so effects heavy. It's like 10% of our budget usually goes to makeup effects, and that's actually kind of been true all the way through. Pretty solid number, but it's more or less like, you know, I want the moon, and almost every single time, you know, I've laid out to my effects people, I've used the same ones 4 times now. Mm-hmm. Josh and Sierra Russell, and they just did the new Hellraiser, but that was their first big movie, and then they went right into this, and it was like our first bigger movie together. But you know, they have the sense, the independent sense too, and it's kind of just like we just figure it out, and I show them how I want to shoot things, and it's like really just having a vision of, not a vision, but like having an idea, a pretty specific idea of how you're going to shoot things. Because if the effects people know you're going to shoot something from very specific angles, and you show them those angles, it requires a lot less build on their part, or like, maybe, you know, this head doesn't need to be as detailed, stuff like that. And, you know, I don't know. I just kind of work that shit in and figure out how to shoot it. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't look as good as you want, and you have to be malleable on set and figure out how to shoot around that.
Do you storyboard the sequences that you need practical effects for?
Yeah, some of them. I had the most storyboards in Christmas out of anything. Because I storyboard all the robot shit, because, like, you know, we have to specifically know what we did and didn't need. And then the heads, it's kind of just like, you know, we had to do some of those, like the head crushing on the stairs. We actually reshot that in LA. I rebuilt the fucking staircase, a piece of it, wrapped it in thing and shot it in the garage. Fucking the head split because it didn't look good the first time. But
so you have had an effect that didn't look that you were disappointed. Okay, yeah.
There you go. You just shot it again.
Yeah, that actually has happened a bunch of times. And then one of the things that I do with effects is I also specifically figure out ways that we can shoot certain effects not in our main unit. Because I own the cameras and because I operate and because I can like make it happen really, really with a small crew. There are like big effect scenes, especially in Bliss and VFW and a couple of things in the Christmas movie that like we just shot with like three or four people. And then actually, for instance, like the robot scene at the end of, cause you guys have seen Christmas, that robot scene at the end with her was 2 weeks of shooting. In the first week, it was the last 2 weeks of shooting of the movie. In our first week, I storyboarded it so that we shot everything with the actress and the robot in the same shot, or everything with the actress. And then cut almost our entire crew, all the actors, or her, everything, a really big skeleton, or a really tiny skeleton crew. And then we went back and reset up the record store to its original thing, and then spent the second week as a skeleton crew, technically a second unit week with like six or seven people. And then I shot all of just the robot specific shots of just the robot doing certain things so that we could then spend time on that we didn't need to do. So like that was, you know, an 8-page scene that we ended up shooting for 2 weeks. But one of those weeks was way cheaper because now there's not 30 people.
Dude, that's so fucking good. That's, I love that so much.
I mean, it also sounds like you're like the AD of your movies in a
way. It's the way that I work. Like I don't know if I simultaneously piss people off or make their jobs easier, but like, you know, my scripts have like the lighting in them, camera shots, and like I just, in my mind, because of how I, you know, on Bliss we didn't even have an AD because that movie was supposed to be 8 people, and on this my AD was kind of like, it's like I want somebody to tell me what time it is and where things are. I don't want somebody how to shoot something. Tell me, hey, you've only got 4 hours left and let me fucking figure out how to shoot it.
Right.
What, you telling me how I'm gonna shoot the fucking movie? Just in order to get a green light, we needed to submit a budget and a schedule. And I always do my budgets and schedules. VFW, obviously, somebody else did, but then I ripped them apart and they fucking, you know, went with mine. But on this, you know, like I did the budget and the schedule, and of course we had a line producer AD come on, but they used my original budget and schedule as like, all right, here's
it's the blueprint. Time. Yeah, yeah.
Because the UPM is like, how the fuck are you, the line producer is like, how the fuck are you going to, this is impossible. And I'm like, well, I guess this isn't the job for you then. So I'll find somebody who isn't willing to say that because I'm telling you it's fucking possible. Just like, and again, I don't need you to budget things for me. I just need you to tell me this is starting to go over budget. What do you need? You know, I want that stuff. I don't want somebody to, because again, like I'm so ingrained in how much things cost. And, you know, I think it's such a big thing to be a producer who's also a filmmaker, because I know that my scene's going to be better if we spend money here and not here, where other people who are producers are like, well, this is the way I make movies and this is how we usually do things. And it's like, yeah, well, I don't fucking care how you usually do things. Here's how I do things. I'm telling you, I don't need that. I don't need a script supervisor. Like, I've never used a script supervisor. Fucking waste of money. The one time I had one, get the fuck out of here. Like, I waste the fucking money.
I love that you, not only do you not have a script supervisor, but like, are you monitoring? How, forgive me, it's been a long, like, I haven't shot 16 since film school, which is a long fucking time ago. So who else can see what's happening on screen? Just you? Just the camera operator?
It depends how fast we're moving.
Yeah.
I have HD taps set up to my.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. What am I thinking?
Like a wireless, like a Teradek type of deal.
Yeah. And like, you know, the 16 cameras or film cameras, they have a tap, but they always would look like VHS or whatever. But I actually had HD ones installed. So it looks like the fucking red when you're looking at it, like the monitor.
Cool.
But you know, my secret that my, cast doesn't necessarily know is I have a monitor that can record on the monitor. So it's recorded. So, and like, you're not looking at the 16 space. Phone camera like that they put next to the thing, so you're seeing the exact frame and it just allows you playback. So like my producing partner Josh Uthier is also my editor, and he's on set with me the whole time. And it's like, if there is a question, more so if you're shooting on digital, it's like there's even less of a reason for a script on digital, because it's like, hey, can you bring up that shot? And in fucking all these producers want dailies on their iPad that they don't fucking watch. So it's like, bring up the fucking daily on an iPad in 4 seconds. You can look at it. Oh, let's have a, was the cup like that? I don't know. Bring it up, motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Oh, there it is. See, like, I don't, you know what I mean? It's just the technology doesn't need, and I mean, and me, because I'm the camera operator and we're shooting, like, I just, you know, I don't know if it's a cocky thing, but I just feel like I know what my frame was. I know where I picked up. I know. And it's never let me down. And there's times when it's like, yeah, let's double check that. And within 5 seconds, my editor can bring it up, you know? So yes,
yeah.
Mr.
Mike. Yeah, hell yeah, man. I love it. I love it.
You know, I don't want to say who it was, but I did a podcast and one of the people on the podcast is like a teacher at a film school. And I'm like, I'm saying all this stuff. And they're like, well, this is not what you should be telling film students. Way to make a movie, like I'm just gonna be fucking honest. I don't know, like, sure, that's not for everybody, but that's how I do it. I don't know. What do you want?
Yeah, man. Well, and I guess have there ever been instances when you're in the edit where you're like, dang, I missed that, and has it ever really been a problem?
Sure, I mean, that comes up, but I think that's not like because of that situation. I think it's more like, oh, I wish that I had gotten this insert. I thought maybe it would have played without it, or maybe it would have played differently. But there are a lot of times when I can just go and, you know, shoot those inserts or like shoot things to get around. You know? And it might not necessarily be what I would have done if I fixed it on set, but there are ways to fix things, you know.
Can we talk a little bit about like just acting and casting and performances and stuff? Like, you know, in Christmas, you have Riley Dandy, one person that's very much like in every single scene and kind of carrying the movie and has like a pretty intense performance, like almost from like the very first frame. Like she's either arguing with people or yelling at people or fighting with people or having sex with people or running away from people. Like how do you prepare for stuff like that? And I mean the whole cast, obviously once, you know, the killing starts, like everyone's pretty serious, like pretty intense. Like, can you tell us a little bit about like that, like kind of what you tell your actors and like how you get kind of these performances?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it's on the page. And I also work with a lot of the same actors. So like in Christmas, everybody besides Riley and Sam, who are the two leads, are people that I've worked with before or that I'm friends with and I've wanted to work with. So a lot of it comes from like, as I add more people to the stable, I write roles specifically for them that I think that they can embody. And with Riley and Sam specifically, you know, a lot of credit does go to RLJ and Shudder, because even though it's a $2 million movie, they were non-cast contingent. They let me cast whoever the fuck I wanted, which was huge, because with a movie like this, because like it is such a specific role. And I mean, she's fucking playing me basically, which I think that, you know, what she very quickly learned. And I think spending 9 weeks, you know, together in a tiny town, she was able to kind of sponge my personality, which helped her riffing on certain things.
Where did you guys shoot?
What was that?
Where did you shoot?
Yeah, it was very
Placerville. So
wait, you said Placerville?
Yeah.
Dude, my parents used to live in Placerville. That's so funny. That's fucking wild, man. That is really crazy. I can't believe I didn't. They'll be excited to hear that. Anyway, sorry. Yeah.
So like when, because it's so specifically me, you know, when I was, and that's another thing too, is like, since they didn't need me to cast a name, which, you know, I was very much against, you know, I don't want to offer this to some fucking stupid WB actor or some shit, doesn't want to do it because it is such a specific role and I want to see them saying this shit. So like, you know, I got a really great casting director, Amy Renee, who casts like, you know, Jim Cummings, a lot of really kind of voracious indies. She got the material and I just, you know, she fucking auditioned a ton of people and I narrowed the list down, and Riley was like able to nail the Pet Sematary 2 monologue with such conviction that it's like, well, surely this would convince people to watch Pet Sematary. Like, this is fucking, like, it sounds like me, you know, giving a late night rant to my friends. And then, you know, she was able to nail the monologue. So she's able to do that. And then in our second round, it's very important to me, like I was talking about, that, that they can take new dialogue on the fly or the riff thing. So like in the second round of auditions, I kind of gave her new material on the spot, see how she did it. And then I acted like, you know, the other actor in the scene to see how she would riff. And I mean, she was riffing stuff that sounded like I had written it. It was kind of that where I was just like, not only is she nailing this stuff in like the almost exact tone, but she's like riffing very, very instinctually. And
really, and you're doing this like in an audition room?
Fucking Zoom. I wish it was an audition room, but it was on Zoom, which was awful because I also couldn't do chemistry reads. So like, I had to go off of my, you know, instinct that they would have good chemistry together. So it was just that. And then it's like, you know, I had to have a very serious, like, it's hard because once somebody's good at that, it then has to be like, just so you know, this is how I work and this is how it's going to be. But I'm going to be, and I think me being the camera operator goes a long way. And she, you know, always says this, but like the fact that
at the end of the movie, she's getting covered in freezing cold water on a 20-hour day and doing all these stunts. It's like, well, I'm going to be there on the camera getting soaked. I'm not going to wear a fucking wetsuit. And then every stunt that she would do, it's like, you're going to jump off. You're going to fall off of that thing on the ground. I'll do it first. Oh, you're going to stab this robot and it's going to explode. I'll do it first. Oh, you're going to drive that car around a dangerous turn. It'll be me and you in the car. I'm going to be on the hood with the camera. So like, there was never a moment where she thought that she would be doing something that was, like, if I wasn't doing it with her. So it's like, and that's another reason why I love being the camera. It's like, we clear everybody the fuck out of the room. It's me, the camera, and the actors, and we all have the floor. And like,
no boom ops.
What was that?
No boom operators.
If they're in my way, I tell them to fucking leave. It's so, it's so annoying too, because it's like, well, we need good sound. It's like, okay, cool. What about those $10,000 labs that are fucking attached to all the actors? And it's like, oh, we can't do the 360 shots as a boom guy. I'm like, okay, so I'm not going to do a cool shot because the fucking boom guy doesn't know how to do his job. Like, okay. Well, and then, you know, on this movie specifically, I had really bad boom up in the first half. And then the second half, like, who was saying shit like that? Like, well, I don't know. And I'm like, oh, okay, we'll do it on last. Get the fuck out of the room. And then we had a second boom up because I think that one got so mad that I just kept telling him to leave. And the second boom up fucking boomed the whole movie. And I probably saw him once. That definition of a great boom up.
Yeah, they're like the ninjas. I have the sound guy I worked with, Josh Bissett. I don't know if you remember them, Matt, but he was like we would do a whole feature and no one would know him at the end of the feature. This guy's like the best sound guy I've ever met.
No, that's a good call.
No, they're like, where's Josh at the rap party? Like, oh, forgot. Is he on this?
Party? Oh, that's the boom guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you very well, guys.
Can I ask about the driving for a second? Because I've shot, you know, actors driving and acting before, and I've, you know, usually it's fine, but sometimes, you know, they're like not that comfortable driving, you know, mm-hmm. on a real street and stuff and acting. Obviously the driving you're having these people do is like insane. No windshields, you know, broken glass, like blood all over their face, nighttime lights mm-hmm. flashing in their eyes. Do you use process trailers also, or like, what's your, like, tell me a little bit about shooting driving in cars.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we just drove, and I was like, all right, we're here, we are. And I don't know, you know, she was excited about all this stuff. And the ambulance, specifically at the end, we actually did have a stunt driver there. We hired a stunt driver and we hired a stunt coordinator was going to play Santa, but we got there and Riley was like, did the first take. And she was like, well, this is awesome. And then she just ended up doing every single take. And same thing with Abe, who was Santa. Like, because I'm, you know, when he's on the back of the ambulance, I'm also strapped in the back and I'm like holding kind of my shoulder.
Yeah. They're
both shooting, and like, it was fucking awesome. And I'm
Actually, you're reminding me. So wait, so there's a shot where Santa is hanging off the back of the ambulance, and then you pan across the ambulance. There isn't a cut, is there, where you, and then you get, wait, so how did you get that shot?
I was in the back of a car.
Car to car. Okay. Yeah.
The road shut down. So,
sure.
And we just had one of our effects guys. I was in the back of his pickup and we were speeding along. And that shot wasn't planned because I thought that Riley wasn't going to drive. But once she started driving, I was like, all right, well, we need this shot. Obviously, we need to do this shot. Like, we can see both of them in the one thing. And we had a blast. And it was just like, yeah, we had a road shut down. I'm in the back of a pickup. You know, my DP's operating B cam. There's a fucking snow machine. There's a van with a snow machine strapped to the top of it in front. And we're just fucking, you know, driving up and down. And then I'm like, all right, strap me into the back of the fucking thing. I want to be there, like, you know, operating with him while I'm hanging off the back, and then throw me in the back and let the doors flap. And it was a fucking blast.
Wait, the snow machine is shooting snow in front of you guys, so it looks like you're driving through snow.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole movie is actually really... Here's another thing, too, is everybody's like, well, how did you have the budget to do all this snow? The snow machines we used are like $200 on Amazon, and we had two PAs just...
What's the snow? Like soap or something?
Yeah, it's like literally like the shit that you... kind of equivalent of like car wash stuff. But when it's cold, it sticks and it looks like snow on the ground. But yeah, I mean, that it's literally a fogger, like a fog machine, and they put a certain solution in it. It's the snow. I don't know. Again, on Amazon, so it's snow fluid. You know, I just typed it. Sure. You put like a pantyhose over the. It's like a little condom over the fucking.
Like the nozzle or whatever. Yeah.
Does something where like it pushes through those little holes and it pushes the soap out and makes it into snow. Yeah. So that was actually one of our most logistical. It was cheap and easy, but you know, the second the wind changes, and then like if you're doing something like on the walk and talk, obviously the snow's gonna be falling in front of them, but I have a wide shot, so you mm-hmm. need to not see the snow machine. So it's like just figuring out the logistics of that. But I mean, that was literally just PAs that whole movie with two cheap snow machines.
Did you shut down the town effectively? Like, what was it like shooting in a small town that you're not from? You know, has Hollywood come to town for them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure, as you know, Placerville is a very divided town. So, you know, we've got, you know, half of it's MAGA people and half of it's just, you know, chill people. So, like, at first, the MAGA people are like, fucking Hollywood coming in fucking town. Even though we're bringing $2 million to the fucking town.
Sure.
But, like, you know, we would just shut down the Liar's Bench, which I don't know how familiar you are with Placerville, but the main, but the dive bar on Main Street is Liar's Bench. So we would just shut that down fucking every night we had off. And a lot of the town people were super cool and they would come out and watch stuff happen. But because we shot at night, overnights the whole time, the fucking place shuts down. Like, that's another thing that sure. sucks. The place shuts down at 7 p.m. So we'd sleep all day Saturday and Sunday and there's nowhere to get anything fucking to eat because everything shuts down at 7. But because of that, it was, like, very easy for us to shut down the streets and
mm-hmm. you could take over anything then. Yeah,
it was I'd never been there. I wanted to shoot close to LA, close enough to LA where I could do pre-pro here because everybody came from LA and, you know, I didn't want to, like, spend 8 weeks of pre-pro there. So I was kind of going back and forth up until we shot. We didn't need to worry about tax incentives either, so I was like, I just want to shoot in California. But I had never been there and we were scouting towns all over California. Me and my producer partner drove to like 30 of them and it was so wild. That was the last one and it was almost like I wrote it for that town because that fucking Main Street, besides those two houses up in Pollock Pines or whatever, we spent 6 weeks on Main Street and like the record store was just an empty building, like an empty white room that was said had a four lease sign. And then next to it was a fucking building that looked like it used to be a police station that had a four lease sign on it. And then three fucking buildings down was this giant toy store that somehow is able to survive in this tiny town that is like fucking FAO Schwartz. And then the bar that was just an empty bar on top of the record store thing. It was just like, it was supposed to originally a two thing complex and like, they just never ripped out the bar. So we just, I was like, oh, look, these three places are for lease. We called them up, like, can we do like a 3 month rental? And then we shut down the street obviously, or we had, when we were doing the walk and talks and anything that wasn't chases, we were able to shoot on the street, but we couldn't shut it down, but nobody was driving anyway. So for like 6 weeks, it was literally like the fucking Universal Studios backlot. It was like, we just roll to fucking Main Street. It's like, oh, I'm going to go check on the police station. Oh, okay. Well, here's our staging today. Or here's our, you know, where we're eating lunch, or here's our fucking production office today. It's like over here. And like, we just literally, me and my 20 fucking friends who are making the movie, we just hanging out fucking on the street, you know. There's a fucking weed shop right in the middle of the street. The fucking bar's open at 2. Everybody's just partying all night and fucking shooting a goddamn movie. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah, man. Living the dream, Joe.
Yeah. Can I ask, I want to ask one more question about the driving scenes just because they're so good. Like, what do you have, like, a speed that you feel like is like a good speed to drive that you can still make a car look fast, but still, you know, the camera's not like bouncing all over the place and you can still stage things and block things. You're not running out of street to shoot on.
Well, it's hard to say because I guess we use such shit cars. Every time I've done a car scene in a movie, they're flooring it. So it goes faster. And yeah, so it just goes as fast as possible. And then you tell Riley, so go as fast as you feel safe. And she just fucking punched the gas and floor it. And I'm the operator, so I'm just like strapped in, and I don't have to worry about somebody else bouncing around or something. Cause I can do that. And then, you know, you just put on the widest, you know, I also found on this, you know, if you're shooting exteriors, tight lenses look good, but if you can get a super wide lens and get up close, it looks even better, like Mad Max style. You know, we were shooting some of the stuff, like when she's running over Santa, and it's like, I put this fucking, just like, almost a fisheye, like the widest you can get without a fisheye, like seeing, you know, the
like vignetting,
with everything coming at you on a super lens, like with the snow, it really kind of gives you an effect that you're fucking flying. But I mean, honestly, they were probably going like 35 in all the driving scenes. It's just that those cars were so fucking shitty that was top speed.
yeah I feel like 35 is kind of the sweet spot where it's like everyone has very clear control, but it still feels like you're going pretty fast, you know, like 35 miles per hour is actually fast, just relative to driving on a freeway or whatever. It's different.
There's a scene where there's this big military truck and William Sadler is actually driving it. So you get William Sadler driving this thing, and I wanted an up close shot of his face, and the sun was coming up, and we didn't have time to rig, you know, a fucking stupid grip on that movie. I hated him. He's like, well, it's gonna take too long to rig something to the car. So I was like, so you tell me I got William Sadler, you know, driving a military convoy as the sun's coming up, and I can't shoot his face driving the military convoy. And I was like, well, I'm just gonna go up and hang on to the side of the convoy and shoot in the window. And the producer and the stunt coordinator, like, absolutely not. You will not do that. We'll shut down production. And I'm like, oh my fucking God. I was like, okay, whatever. So I went up to Sadler and I was like, hey, I'm going to jump on the car when I call action, okay? So I went back and I had the camera on my shoulder and I'm like, action. I ran full speed up onto the convoy, grabbing the thing, and my fucking thing, and he just shoot and busted through a fence, and I shot the whole thing. And the producer's like, "I swear to God!" I'm like, "What are you gonna do? Fire me 2 days before we finish? Whatever." And the shot looks dope, and it's like,
"Did you use the approach too? Did you get the run? Is that did you use that or no?"
Yeah, it looked like
didn't I was look good. Yeah. Still, man, fuck yeah.
Are you're shooting mainly handheld?
It depends on the situation, you know. I used Steadicam for the first time on Christmas.
Right, like the whole opening sequence, right?
Zoom work. VFW was like the first 20 minutes. I put us because it's like 7 actors, and the first 20 minutes of that movie are them just bullshitting at a bar. So I basically and we shot that movie in 18 fucking days because it was just so it was so low budget. And on that movie, I specifically just got a 10-foot slider, and I staged it in a way where I could shoot 2 cameras and basically nail pop off coverage.
Like you were operating both cameras?
No. My DP was on the second one, but like it's like I'm going to be the main on the slider, and then you pop off these lines. So like we were able to get 12 pages basically in a day. And in handheld, that wouldn't have worked as much. But other scenes where they're actually walking around the bar and that, I did handheld. And I also like that because it's almost like you're a dancer on the stage there. And it was like, okay, well, we're going to combine these 3 scenes and do 9 pages at once. And let's figure this out. And it's like, you're literally like, it's like a dancer. It's like you're walking over here and then I'm going to whip this way. And I'll have B camera grab that because I'm going to be moving my camera over here. And like, and we're going to do all top lighting tubes with a lot of neon practicals. That's also why I like doing practical. Like a lot of my practicals built in. And then we can just use key lights like Astera. I shoot a lot of Asteras too. I love the LED film combination. So it's like you get all the practical lights in frame and it's like, okay, we'll just pop an Astera off to the side, just give it a little bit of extra, you know, edging or something like that. I would say probably 50% handheld my movies maybe. But yeah. Also it's, you know, if you go on a wide enough lens, you know, I like to shoot on the 6mm lens on the 16. So even if you're walking around.
Wait, did you just say a 6mm lens?
Yeah. It's probably like a 14 or something, right?
Yeah.
For 16, it's about it's probably about a 10-ish. Okay. And I'm trying to find the widest I can get without fisheyeing. I just found a 5.5 that doesn't fisheye. That's a little bit wider, but So all that not all the POV stuff. Some of it's anamorphic on Christmas, but yeah, the 6mm. A lot of Bliss I shot on the 6mm. A lot of the movie I'm shooting right now has POV stuff that I shot in the 6mm lens. It's my favorite lens. It looks fucking incredible.
So and you don't really care that. That the human eye doesn't look like you don't want your POV shots to mimic the human.
Well, or a robot, right. A robot's field of view might be wider, right?
I don't know, man. I think 3.5 with the 6mm looks pretty close to my eye.
You have incredible peripheral vision.
Yeah. I feel like my peripheral vision is far too narrow.
But so you have like a scene in Christmas, Bloody Christmas where. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of crazy destruction, lasers, like insanity happening. But just an example of one scene is like when the ambulance crashes into something and like someone flies through the front window. Like, I guess if I had that stunt and a shoot day, I would probably allocate like at least half the shoot day to doing something like that. Like how fast can you do a stunt like that?
Yeah.
You know, where you have a body, you know, whether it's a dummy or a real body or whatever, like flying through a window, breaking glass at night, you have to light it. Like, how long does something like that take someone like you?
Well, that scene specifically, we had the crash into the car, then the body going through the windshield, and then an explosion. So we kind of did all 3 of those things back to back, and the scene was lit because it's a parking lot, like for all 3 essentially. But with that, like, we piled all that stuff into the first half of the day, and our lunch would be like midnight or whatever. And because everything after that was dialogue, we were able to have our stunt and effects team come in earlier and set that stuff up before the crew got there. And like, I got there early, obviously, and I had storyboards for that. And we saw, like, we did tests to see how it would work, and we knew how this was going. The biggest fucking time suck on that was we had 3 windshields that was breakaway, and so we could do it 3 times, and installing the breakaway window the second and third time after the cruising, it was the longest fucking thing. But it was just, it was literally like a crash test dummy that you could buy online.
And is it a real, like, are you launching it or pulling it?
So basically what they did was they put like a piece of pipe between its legs that stuck out just a tiny bit, but it went through the whole body. and then they put it on an air cannon so that it was connected and pointed at the windshield. Uh-huh. And basically, it would be like a thing where it was like 1, 2, 3, and we had like a winch or whatever that would like nudge the car so that it would have that thing. And on 1, 2, 3, it would go boom, and then they would hit. When they felt the car nudge, they would hit the fucking laser Acme thing, a big red button, and it would shoot through the glass and fly out.
Fire the pneumatic cannon dummy.
Yeah.
And the dummy is actually breaking the glass. There's nothing separate breaking
like
the glass.
Like
the
way glass. It's like soup, you know. And that was also so fucking long to install because you have to be meticulous to like, and it had to. But yeah, it was breakaway glass, but it was a pretty hard dummy. And that was another thing is like, you know, the practical effect guy's like, well, I don't know how you're going to do this because windshields are really hard to get through. And we can't have breakaway glass because if somebody went through a windshield, it would just be a hole because they're meant not to shatter. It wouldn't shatter. And I was like, nobody's going to care. And then I watched this movie called Body Parts while I was in pre-production. And it was just like, I just got the new Blu-ray, so I had it on. And there's a scene where that motherfucker, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it has one of the coolest car crashes at the beginning. The guy hits a thing on the highway and his body flies through the windshield. And they show from like 4 different angles and the fucking windshield explodes into a million pieces. And I'm like, told you.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks about the fact that, wait, that windshield shouldn't shatter. And it's like,
sure.
The weird, practical, realistic things people think about. It's a fucking movie. It's a killer robot movie. I don't care how windshields realistically fucking shatter. Like, calm the fuck down.
And what was it, another situation where you're like, well, let me just see how much breakaway windshield glass costs?
No, because it's going to, at that point, it's like a windshield's $200 anyway, or $300. And you have to have the guy, to install it anyway. So it's like, I don't know, it was probably $200 more or something like that. But if it was a real windshield, that's the thing, is it wouldn't go through because they are meant to not shatter. So it's like, that was the thing, is he was like, I don't understand how I manufacture something that it can go through, but also replicates what I'm like, dude, just break my fucking glass, who cares? Like, you know, and on my first couple movies, it was so low budget that we made breakaway glass and it's just sugar and water and you cook it in the fucking oven. But like on this, you know, I don't have an oven big enough to make a windshield. But like on my first movie, I was making them for like side windows. And
fuck yes, Joe. That's fucking so awesome. That's so hardcore. Like it's truly inspiring to just be like, oh, I'm just going to go make my own breakaway glass is so fucking awesome, dude.
Well, because
is it the same as sugar
glass? Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah. Though, listeners at home, if you ever buy breakaway glass from like a prop shop or whatever, it's not sugar. So don't eat it and tell everyone not to eat it, because inevitably someone will be like, oh, this is just sugar glass. Let me taste it. And then they're like eating plastic or whatever. It's like bad for you if you buy the real stuff.
I was doing it for car windows on my first movie, like side windows, and they didn't fit exactly. I was just making big squares.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like tape it. And then you cut on the shatter and nobody can, like, there's fucking gaps, but like you cut and outside, somebody's putting their elbow, and then you cut inside and the glass is flying at the fucking camera and nobody's, no, I forget that it's a square.
Fucking awesome.
You know?
Yeah. That is fucking awesome, man. That's so great.
Well, yeah, I come from the Peter Jackson way of filmmaking where it's like, you just fucking figure shit out. I think that's what lends itself to now, even though I have a couple $1 million, I'm still just doing things that way, but putting my money into robots and explosions and like,
right.
Oh yeah, I've got $2 million. That doesn't mean I'm going to hire 80 people and fucking, you know.
Well, Joe, we'll have to have you come back. I'm sure you're going to have 6 more movies in the next year. So, you know, anytime.
This one, I got to get this one off my fucking plate.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
What's next? Is the plan to kind of keep directing features? Like, would you ever like produce, write, or do TV or anything?
I don't really want to do TV unless it's the right thing, because I don't want to join the DGA. And also, I have a couple of friends who went into the TV world and became very comfortable, and they make less features now. I don't want to get hypnotized by that. Try not to set myself up for that. Writing, I would be down to write something, like, as long as it was something I didn't want to direct, you know, I'd be okay, or like that I wouldn't feel bad about putting my name on. But I think a lot of people think my strengths are directing, so nobody's really going to hire me to write anything, but I would. I've went out for writing jobs before. But I want to stick with features. It's definitely my main thing. I love features. I love cinema. That's, you know, why I do this. I'd love to do music videos of bands that I like, but it's so annoying because, you know, like my reps are like, well, you know, a lot of music video directors want to direct features too. And I'm like, yeah, but like, I think it's harder to direct. Like, I don't know. Isn't it more appealing to music to bands like that a feature director wants to direct your music video? You know, like, there's nobody's directing, you know, $50,000 Mastodon videos. Like, why can't I go direct one of those?
Sure.
And also, like, because I write so many scripts that don't get financed, or I write more scripts than get financed, like, I had more time practicing writing. And I wish I could practice directing, or, like, not practice, but, like, if I have an idea for shots or, like, little things, I'd rather be able to, like, get in the field and try that shit out in an experimental way that, you know, not have to wait every 2 years to make a movie or every year or whatever. But just by the nature of the game, I put so much time and energy into features. It's a long time to write something and try to get money, and I usually just don't have time to kind of pursue other stuff.
That's awesome. Yeah, well, it's an exciting career you have, and it obviously sounds like you really enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, it's a hard job, you know, but I love it. It's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, man. Well, do you have a few more minutes to hang out and endorse with us?
Sure.
Unpaid endorsements.
So, you know, I got this Nespresso machine. I've been making you know, whenever, coffees. And for my kid, I make the, I talked about the baby chino, right? You just, it comes with this frother. You'll be disgusted, but I put like half milk, half and half, and then I froth it. I put like vanilla in there, and I just like bought, you know, vanilla off Amazon, you know, Joe Biggest style.
I hate to sound like I'm endorsing Amazon so much. I fucking hate Amazon, but they're so easy. And like,
yeah, no, we everyone has a love-hate relationship with them.
Yeah, I think everyone's in that boat of like, oh god. Well, yeah. I mean, what else? You are you going to go to Walmart to get your fog machine? You know what I mean? Like, it's the same fucking problem. So
I bought like that thing that they have at like all the coffee shops, like the Tarani vanilla syrup. It's like in this big pitcher, and it comes with a pump. Mm-hmm. And it's, I just feel like, it just feels so cool when my daughter comes over, she does like a pump of vanilla into her baby chino, and it's just like, it's just real living the high life here. So I guess I'm endorsing the Tarani vanilla syrup with the pump. You only have to buy the pump one time, then you just buy the vanilla syrup. But I am like someone that does not drink any sugar in any of my coffee drinks, but for some reason, like, started putting a little vanilla in my coffee, and it makes me kind of happy in the afternoon. Only in the afternoon. Not fucking around in the morning.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
All right, so Tarani syrup is your endorsement. I mean, I don't have anything.
I told you it's a really bad one.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. Joe.
I guess I'll endorse what I think is my favorite movie of the year so far, because I think it's criminally underseen. But, you know, I've had such a busy year. I'm trying to catch up on fucking movies that I missed this year, but I'm shooting and fucking releasing a movie. I'm trying my best. But there's this movie that I watched a couple months ago called Dinner in America. Have you guys heard of it?
Yeah. Remind me, what is it?
So it was at Sundance in 2020 and took forever to get released. I think I know why now, watching it. It's pretty politically incorrect, but like not in a bad way, I guess. It's just, you know, everybody's so touchy nowadays. But like it's this really kind of sweet, but punk, gutter punk comedy. It's almost like Heather's, it says this in the trailer, so I hate to say this, but it's like Heather's meets Napoleon Dynamite, but it's honestly like a really good fucking, it's just this great movie where, you know, it's this dude who's in a punk band and he wears a mask and it's a super underground punk band. And he kind of just couch surfs and he meets up with chicks from the shows and stays at their house. And it opens up with like him staying at this chick's house and the dad's super racist, fucking asshole. So the kid ends up burning down the house and like it's just middle America, like the worst of the worst, like shit towns in middle America. And he goes around and he has this girl who's like a huge fan of his who sends him Polaroids of like her masturbating and like fucking orgasming, and he doesn't know who she is and she doesn't actually know who he is, and he ends up meeting up with her at a festival or a show, an underground basement show, and crashes at her place. He doesn't know that she's the girl who sends these pictures and she doesn't know that he's the singer of the band, but he finds the Polaroids and they end up finding that they're, and she's like this super nerdy chick and he's like this fucking crazy like anarchist punk dude, and they end up kind of like just running off together, and it becomes like this thing where like all the characters are just like, at first it's like they're all like the worst fucking assholes, but then like they all kind of grow, and by the end of the movie it's like, I don't know. It's just, it's a type of movie that's definitely not made anymore. It felt very, very, very Sundance early 90s, like a movie that.
Pat Healy's in it. Isn't he in every Sundance film?
Kyle Gallner, who I've never like, has never stuck out to me before, like kills it in this fucking movie. And it's just really good. It's on Hulu now, and Arrow put out the Blu-ray in the UK, which is where I first saw it. I wrote it, but now it's on Hulu. But like, yeah, I think more people are talking about it now, and slowly now that it's more available. But like, I don't think anything stuck with me that this year so far that much. And I'm not sure what else would. Doesn't really seem like there's a lot of things on the horizon. You know, I'm seeing Avatar tomorrow, which I'm super excited about. But I think after I walk out of the theater, I won't think about it again. But yeah, Dinner in America is my unpaid endorsement because I feel like, you know, indie movies like that need all the eyes they can get.
Hell yeah, man. That's cool. Yeah. So my unpaid endorsement is Weird, the Weird Al Yankovic story, which you can watch for free if you just go to Roku.com, but you do have to watch a few commercials. Yeah, that is the deal. You know, there's not that many of them. Mostly it's upfront, and then there's maybe two ad breaks in between.
Are they in good places? Like they're putting
They're in good places. And also, like, it's a film that's not so immersive that, like, you get pulled out of the world of Weird Al when when the ad comes on. Do you know what I mean? I think he's, like, so saturated in, like, Americana and pop culture that, like, you know, I wish they'd done a couple fake commercials like they used to do, like in UHF. Like if there were a couple UHF style commercials, like kind of wrapping around the Roku commercials, that would be the fucking best. But, you know, they were busy. It's really fun. It's really zany. If you like Weird Al, then obviously it's for you. I really had a great time as a person who loves the other parody biopic film, Walk Hard. It's a great doubleheader right there of just like straight up zaniness and funny songs. So if you're on the fence on it, I would say go for it for sure. It delivers exactly what it's promising. So
yeah, I'm going to watch it for sure.
Yeah. Watch it with your kid, man.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah. I don't think there's some gun violence. I don't know where you stand on that.
Is it interesting enough?
I think it's real goofy, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's silly. You know, Weird Al sometimes has kind of like he'll go weirdly dark, like surprisingly dark. I don't think any of that is in this one. I think it's pretty straight laced. I guess there's some drunk driving stuff that's like over the top, but
my daughter's into that.
Yeah. Yeah. She loves it. Joe was operating. He was on the hood of the car as Daniel Radcliffe was driving around. It was crazy.
Like, Joe, we'd rather you not be. Well, cool, man. Thanks. Are you on social media? Obviously we found you on social media.
People have just finished listening to this interview. They want to keep track of all of the cool shit you're doing. What's the best way to look you up?
That's my name on Instagram and Twitter. I'm not as active, I guess, as people tell me I should be, but I pop around. I'm on there sometimes.
Yeah.
Joebegos.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, thanks, Joe. If you have questions for us or the show, you can hit us up at justshootitpod across all social media. Email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. Write us a review on like iTunes or Spotify. That helps the show grow and would be really appreciated. And you can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. I'm at Smitey Pileg on Twitter. And this episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Our producer is Tyler Smalls. The music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.